Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host a Courthouse Steps oral argument on Mahmoud v. Taylor, featuring Eric Baxter. Mr. Baxter is Vice President and Senior Counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, where he has represented religious organizations and individuals in a wide array of religious liberty disputes. He frequently appears on national media to discuss religious liberty issues and has written op-eds in many major newspaper publications. Before joining the Beckett Fund, Mr. Baxter was partner at Arndt Fox LLP, and he also served for many years as outside counsel to a DC church and its affiliated school. He is fresh off of arguing before the US Supreme Court this morning, so we're delighted to have him with us to discuss this case. Our moderator for today's discussion is Professor Teresa Stanton Collette. Professor Collette is a professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, where she serves as director of the school's Pro-Life Center. She received her doctorate from the University of Oklahoma College of Law. A prolific scholar, Professor Collette has published numerous legal articles and co-authored books on professional responsibility and Catholic perspectives on American law. She's an elected member of the American Law Institute and has testified before committees of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives. Notably, she also served on the Pontifical Council for the Family under Pope Benedict and Pope Francis. Professor Collette has also represented government officials and medical groups in significant legal cases concerning abortion and parental rights before the U.S. Supreme Court and federal appellate courts. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, thank you both for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Marco. Eric, I'm not sure that all of our viewers have been staying up to date on the case, so why don't you just give us a background? I know it's been going on for over 2 years and you're still just at the preliminary injunction stage, but why don't you tell us about the plaintiffs in this case and what they're seeking?
Yeah, it was actually, I just woke up one morning, my wife was reading the news, and she leaned over and said, "Hey, I think you need to sue Montgomery County Public Schools." And she showed me an article that the board had introduced all these storybooks for kids that really are pushing an extreme gender ideology, starting with pre-K, a book called Pride Parade, where kids are, you know, it's a picture book where kids look for a drag queen, look for zipper, look for lip ring, look for Marsha P. Johnson, who is a sex activist, and kind of just introducing kids in a kind of a gentle way, I suppose, is from their perspective to the concepts that a lot of parents just think 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds shouldn't be thinking about. It started out like no problem because the board said, "You will allow parents to opt out. We'll notify you before we read these books to your kids and you can opt out." And for almost an entire school year, that's what happened. And then on March 22nd, 2023, the board reaffirmed that in the press. We're not sure why they put that out, but they said, "Yeah, you can opt out." The very next day, so overnight, no explanation, they changed course and said, "Actually, we will no longer notify you when these books are read, and we will no longer allow you to opt out, even if you find out." So that was upsetting to a lot of parents. I mean, some of the other books are like A Boy Named Penelope, about a girl who thinks she's a boy. And when she goes to tell her parents, you know, her mom just says, "Oh, whatever you think is right." And she goes to her teacher, like, "You're my teacher today." Sending this idea that, you know, they were told, teachers were told to tell students, doctors guessed at your sex when you were born, and you should pick for yourself whether you're a boy or a girl or both or neither. And this is some of the board's own language. So you can imagine a lot of parents were upset. About 1,000 parents were showing up at school board meetings over the summer of 2023 saying, "Hey, you can't do this." You know, most people don't show up at school board meetings that often. So when you have 1,000 people, there's obviously something going on. And the response from the board, shockingly, was, "Hey, you guys are using religion as another excuse to hate people. they accused a Muslim girl who testified that she didn't want to be reading the books, that she was just parroting her parents' dogma. And then another board member said, you guys are aligning yourselves with white supremacists and xenophobes. And so that kind of just set the tone for everything that happened over the next 2 years. The district court told our clients, we had three named couples and then about 300 families who joined an organization called Kids First, who are also part of the lawsuit. District court told us, well, once you put your kids in school, you have no right as to what they're taught once they get there. There's no burden on your religious belief just because you object to what they're teaching your children. The Fourth Circuit surprisingly upheld that. And we were in front of a couple of judges we thought would rule in our favor. One did in dissent, but the majority ruled that you don't have a burden unless you've actually been asked to change your beliefs, whatever that means. I mean, is it enough just to say to a kid, like, I'm asking you to change your beliefs. Does that give me a burden? Or do I have to like back it up with the threat of ruining your grade or locking you in the closet? And I'm just not sure even what that means, but that's what the Fourth Circuit held. And so we were asking the court today to recognize, just apply the same burden standard they apply to every other government organization. And which, in my view, should apply even more so to the school, which has incredible control over children and almost all the children in the community. They get them for 8 hours a day. And so we should absolutely hold public schools to a strict scrutiny standard where they have to justify before they do things that violate parents' religious beliefs. So that was the issue before the court. And I thought we had a great oral argument today. I'm optimistic, you know, you never know, but there were definitely a lot of concerns, questions like expressing disbelief that the board was making this even happen. They accommodated for a year. Why can't they just keep doing that?
So I had the privilege of listening to your argument today and was very happy to be in the courtroom, and it was pretty lively. One of the lawyers that I was in a waiting room, we were admitting some people to the court, said, oh, I think this is going to be a 9-0 opinion for it. And I said, I don't think so.
There were definitely a couple of justices who weren't necessarily, didn't seem like they were fully on our side yet.
it certainly did not. And then, of course, as always, there were a couple of justices that were just giving you the opportunity to answer the hardest questions so that they could write an effective opinion in this case.
Yes.
You told the justices that you had three different theories about what the burden standard ought to be in this, because the justices did seem as a whole a little concerned about too much interference in the public school system's ability to be organized and to handle the administrative task of allowing opt-outs in this case. Would you just sort of explain to our viewers what those three theories were and how they work in this case?
Yeah, I think the one that's most familiar to lawyers is kind of this idea of pressuring people to violate their religious beliefs as a condition of accessing a government benefit. This goes back to the early Sherbert case where Adele Sherbert didn't want to work on the Sunday, so she had to quit her job. And then the state denied her employment benefits because they thought there was no good cause for not having a job. You know, she quit. And the court said, look, you're basically using government benefits to pressure people to give up their religious beliefs, and you can't do that. And so the court has, there's a long line of these cases. There are more, you know, Thomas and Hobby were both employment, similar kind of employment benefits cases. The recent string of cases, starting with Trinity Lutheran, Espinoza, and Carson versus Macon, where the court said, you know, these are parents who are sending their kids to private school, in some cases, sending their kids to private school, paying the tuition. The state comes along and says, hey, we'll subsidize tuition, but not if you're going to a religious school. So it wasn't even like there was any coercion at all. It's just like, hey, I can't get a benefit that other people can get just because I'm going to a religious school. So that kind of pressure case, there's just a ton of cases on that concept. And we think this is the same thing. Essentially, you're telling parents, you have to go to public schools for most kids, because they can't afford to homeschool, they can't afford to private school. They're already paying taxes to the public school. You know, parents, most people can't afford to homeschool or private school. And if you don't send them to private school, guess what? You get hit with truancy fines and potentially prison. And so you're compelled to go. And now you're saying, but if you come, you have to participate in these classes that violate your religious beliefs. So that same kind of pressure. So that's the first, you know, I think the most obvious avenue. Under the Smith regime, the current Smith regime, where, you know, you don't get relief for laws that are neutral and generally applicable. Once you have that pressure, you still have to show that there's some kind of discrimination that gets you to kind of heightened review from the court. So that was that path. Maybe a little lesser known case, you know, path is under Yoder, which was the 1972 decision involving the Amish. They wanted to pull their kids out of high school starting in ninth grade. The state of Wisconsin said, no, we have mandatory attendance laws through, you can pull them out at 10th grade, after 10th grade, so 11th grade. And so the Amish sued, and the court basically said, look, yeah, this is a substantial interference with your ability to raise your children the way you want to raise them, according to your religious beliefs. This is the period when high schoolers are at a crucial stage of adolescent development. High school environments tend to have what they court called a hydraulic insistence on conformity. So there's lots of pressure, and there was just incidental exposure. There was no one teaching things that were directly contrary to the Amish beliefs, but you know, it's like, you're going to be exposed in high school to competition, careerism, you know, and a worldview that was kind of counter to the Amish, more separationist type views. And the court said that was sufficient to get to strict scrutiny. So we think that we fall easily within that. We're talking about much younger children, much more sensitive topics as far as sexuality, where every state in the nation essentially requires opt-outs or opt-ins before kids can participate. And not incidental interaction with contrary values, but deliberate effort to disrupt your children's thinking. So we think that this is also a very viable path, and one that allows you to avoid the Smith regime, because in Smith, the court said that Yoder was outside of its ruling and kind of could go to strict scrutiny on its own, basically. And the final one is basically this idea, which interestingly, Justice Gorsuch really seemed to glom onto, which is that when there's direct discrimination, a law is not neutral and generally applicable, that itself is the burden because you're being discriminated against. You don't have to show the pressure or anything like that. So those are the three paths. We think any of them, for this case, any one of them works. We'd of course love to have the court, reaffirm Yoder. And, you know, the Smith cases, five justices have already said kind of like Smith is inconsistent with text, tradition, history. So like, I hate to build out a lot of precedent there. And also this neutrality and general applicability is just so malleable. You know, you go back in the school and say, okay, we'll do it again. We won't say mean things to you. And we'll just make the opt-out ban broader. And then you're back in the same position making these arguments. So I think in our view, it would be really nice if the court would kind of give something that would set precedent and allow parents to kind of at least have a say. You know, you don't always win, but you should be able to have a say and at least the option to opt out if it's feasible.
Now, Justice Brown seemed to be, especially because it started off with a pretty lively discussion of Yoder, frankly, seemed concerned and kept pushing you to say that the standards should be different for high school students as opposed to these very young pre-K kindergartners, first, second graders. And you resisted that. And I think in part that was because Yoder, of course, dealt with older students.
Right.
Do you think the court will actually provide some sort of multi-factor test, or are you looking for something simpler than that?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, the question is, do you decide these cases on the burden side of the argument? So when the parties come in and say, our religion is burdened, do you try to resolve it on that side, or do you make the government kind of prove things on the strict scrutiny side, that they have a compelling government interest that can't be met in a less restrictive way? And the court was trying really, you know, a couple of members of the court anyway, were trying to say there's got to be some limits on the burden side, or you'll just open this door, everybody will sue over everything. And it's like, you could do that. The court's never done that before. I mean, there's always in these cases this question about like, oh, what's the extreme thing that's going to happen if we open the door to Hobby Lobby, was an example, having religious beliefs. And a lot of people were saying like, oh, now every company is going to discriminate on religious. You know, it just didn't happen, because in the real world, there aren't that many companies that really act out of their religious beliefs. And so I was trying to say like, look, yeah, actually the burden will differ by age. A lot of our parents wouldn't care if this were high school. But when you're a third grader being told that you're a boy when you're a girl, that's a lot more confusing. And so I think there are just some natural limits in the way the real world operates. The other problem when you decide these on the burden side, you start saying like, well, the Amish, their beliefs are very separatist, so we'll give them. But, you know, these Muslim beliefs, they're not so big of a deal. You start comparing religious burdens and invite religious discrimination and entanglement. Whereas the way the court has always addressed these is like, do you have a sincere religious belief? And is the government prohibiting or inhibiting your exercise? If it is, then the government has to show that it can't permit you to do your religious thing. And that's really, in my view, the approach we take, that's just how it should work. The Bill of Rights is there to protect individuals against the government, not to protect the government against, oh, I don't want so many lawsuits, you know, this is a burdensome to me. And so we were just trying to say, look, just apply the same rules you apply in every other context. We know it sounds scary when they start throwing out these hypotheticals, but if you look at them, there actually aren't that many cases. You know, they have all these cited cases. If you go to look at them, there a lot of them are distinguishable, and a lot of them were decided on strict scrutiny. So this idea that like, oh, the floodgates will open up if we do this is just not true.
One of the points you made also, I thought very effectively, is that this particular school district has a multitude of opt-outs for all sorts of reasons. And so if anything, there's evidence of discrimination in that they won't allow, which to me fits right within the Smith v. Oregon test.
Right.
When you're treating different groups differently and religion gets treated less favorably. And there was some discussion about that. Can you sort of outline for our viewers what some of the other opt-outs are?
Yeah, you know, interesting. One of my moots preparing for this, I'll credit Professor Michael McConnell, who said, you know, look, today our educational system is really designed to meet kind of individual needs of students. We have gifted classes. We have, you know, you have individual education programs for students who have special needs. 1 in 8 students in Montgomery County has an individualized education program. That means that if they have a special need, or they can be opted out of the mainstream class and go and get special help. That's awesome, right? And same with Montgomery County, it's a super diverse county. 15% of its students are take English for speakers of other languages, ESOL. And so they're opted out of English class or some other classes in order to kind of like meet their individual needs. So literally you have thousands of students every day in Montgomery County who are being opted in and out of classrooms, sometimes multiple times a day. And you're telling me that you can't opt out, you know, what they said were dozens of students who just want to go sit in the library during this hour. And then, you know, they tried to make a big deal about like, do you know how hard it is to wrangle 3 and 4 year olds? It's like, you know, there's a librarian, you set kids in a desk for 30 minutes while you read the story. It's going to work out okay. And they did it for a year. We know they did it for a year. We know they're doing this kind of stuff all the time. And so, you know, and really just ask the questions, why did you force this extreme curriculum? I mean, we're not aware of any other schools in the country that are insisting that you teach 3 and 4, 5 year olds such complex and sensitive issues around gender identity, sexuality. I mean, let the kids have a few years where they don't have to think about, am I really a boy? Am I really a girl? Does it mean I'm gay just because I like to play basketball with the guys? You know, every fourth grader, we literally had one teacher who himself was gay, who said he had a fourth grader after one of these classes came in and said, I wonder now if I'm gay because I only like to play with the boys at recess. You're like, yeah, you're in fourth grade. That's what boys in fourth grade do. You know, they like to hang out. So it doesn't mean anything. So it's really just kind of like, can we allow kids to have a period of innocence while they're in elementary school?
I remember in junior high saying, I wish I was a boy, simply because the Boy Scouts were going and doing cool stuff. They were canoeing and horseback cavalcades, and the Girl Scouts, we were learning how to fold napkins.
Well, the ironic thing is we're not even telling the board they can't teach these things. And there are parents who want those things, they can get them. But we're just saying like, okay, but let us sit out. This isn't like math, you know, science reading, you know, anyway.
So it seemed to me, though, that one of the other concerns that Justice Brown had, and at least to some extent, Justice Kagan, who seemed far less hostile, not that any justice would appear hostile on a panel, but nonetheless, was the evidentiary record. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the Fourth Circuit really leaned into the sense that we don't really have any evidence of how the teachers will actually teach it, which in some respects is true because we sued before our kids had, the point of a preliminary injunction is getting relief before your kids have to be exposed to the instruction that would violate your religious beliefs. But in this case, we had a remarkably robust record despite that, because a friendly organization had sued, or not sued, but they had just filed an open records request with Montgomery County and said, we want all of your inside communications with teachers and each other about these. So we got copies of all of the instruction materials that had gone out to teachers. We knew all the books. So there's no question what the board has told teachers to teach. There's these long lists of like answering students' questions. What do I say if a teacher says that's weird that a boy can become a girl? And it says like, well, disrupt their either or thinking on sex. Remind them that Harry Styles wears dresses. Do you think it's fair that, to question what his choice is? So there's all these things. You don't have to choose to be a boy or a girl. You can be both or neither. I mean, so there's instruction that's obviously one-sided, trying to push kids in a certain view of ideology on gender and sexuality. And so the idea that if you believe, as the Fourth Circuit did, that you don't have a burden until you've actually been asked to change your beliefs. And again, I don't even know what that means. Is it enough to say, like, will you change your beliefs? Do you have to twist their arm? Do you have to threaten to lower their grade if they don't agree? I mean, what does that actually mean? And why do you have to wait until that happens? I won't go into the details, but there's like the First Circuit case, Brown versus Hot and Sexy Safe Productions. You can guess from the name. they invited kids up onto the stage to do basically obscene things with a presenter. And it's like, you tell me I have to wait for my 4-year-old to be asked to do that before I can get relief? It's like, no. And I think, Justice Barrett, she was like, well, wait, this is the point of a preliminary injunction. If it's imminent, you can get relief. So I don't think the court's really going to buy it. But, Justice Jackson seemed to have concerns about it. She seemed to think that coercion was the standard. And I'm not exactly sure she was coming from, but seemed to be overlooking all the cases that are about like pressure is enough. Whatever actual coercion means for a 3-year-old. I mean, these are kids who like adore their teachers, and whatever the teacher says, they would probably do it. So I'm not sure that you have to have much more than that to get to a coercion standard, but there was definitely some confusion around that question.
One of our viewers asked the question, or noted, that it's rare for SCOTUS to take a case at the preliminary injunction stage instead of final judgment. Why do you think the court chose not to wait until finality in this case?
I think probably just like the outrageousness of the facts had to have been a factor. And I think, just knowing that there are kids who have these real objections, and, we have families moved out of the county, families that pulled their kids into private school. Some of the people in one family had to move in with their grandparents in order to afford that. Another family literally lost $25,000 in services that the school made available to their daughter because of her Down syndrome. And, those parents were especially concerned because their daughters, she doesn't have the capacity to, she idolizes her teachers, doesn't have the full capacity to be able to discern. And so they felt like she was especially vulnerable to the suggestions that teachers might be putting into her mind. And so they had no choice but to pull her out. But that's a huge hit when you have to provide the kind of replace those services yourself, even though you're still paying taxes to support the school. So this is, a real hardship for lots of families. And I may have forgotten where the question was headed, but that's
the question was, why do you think the court took it at this point?
Oh, yeah. So I think
finality.
I think just kind of like the outrageousness of the board saying, like, we're going to do this overnight, without telling you, calling you names, not giving you any rights. And there's real harm going on. So it seemed like an important case, I think. And I think, Yoder's been sitting around for 50 years, 50 plus years. And I think that it may be that the court is aware, it's maybe time to like kind of clarify and reaffirm the meaning of Yoder. That's one of the things I'm hoping for. Anyway.
There's also seemed to be a lot of curiosity across the bench on the difference between exposure and education or indoctrination. How do you distinguish the classroom that has, Johnny has two daddies or Susie has two mommies in the classroom library, as opposed to what's happening in Montgomery County?
You know, it's interesting because initially when I was kind of thinking about how to frame this case, I was really doing a lot of work to try to distinguish exposure from, you know, indoctrination or instruction. And by the time I got through several moots and kind of got beat up enough times around the issue, I was like, you know what? It really just depends on your religious belief. And, you know, almost every parent in America would have an objection to their kid being exposed to pornography, or imagine like extreme graphic violence, right? That's a burden if you're put into a situation where you're coerced to put your child in school and then teachers can show you your kids that kind of stuff without ever telling you or getting your permission. And so it was kind of like, yeah, we kind of have to be open to the idea that burdens can be broad. It doesn't mean you always win. And so, and it's funny because like the board in their response brief, I'm not even sure why they did this, but they dropped a footnote saying, basically in response to something the U.S. solicitor said, but they said, well, if Muslim students were exposed to pictures of the Prophet Muhammad, we would opt that out. And it's like, okay, so now even they agree that some exposure is enough. So the question then is like, I at some point I was like, I'm not going to try to distinguish this because it's a very fine line. Like, what's the difference between exposure? Is reading to them exposure or is it instruction? Is it, you know, and even books on the shelf. I mean, some parents do object to their kids being in a room with the books on the shelf because they don't want their kids to have to read the books, but they're not suing over it. And it just, the reality is that parents aren't bringing those kinds of claims. They know when they're going to school, they're kind of making a deal that there's going to be some things that they won't agree with, and they tolerate an awful lot sometimes, but this really pushed them over the edge. And so I think just in general, what I was trying to assure the court is like, there are actually a lot of, you know, cause they give all kinds of hypotheticals. What if this, what if they don't want to be in a classroom with a gay teacher? What if they don't like interracial marriage? Which interestingly, the Bob Jones case, the court did say, look, there's still a burden. Even if your religious views are racist, there's still a burden. But you're just going to lose on strict scrutiny. And that's what I was trying to say. It's like, look, yes, there's always going to be someone who maybe brings an extreme claim, but it's very rare. Most parents are too busy to kind of sue over every little thing. There are states around the country that have very, very broad opt-out policies for anything that you find controversial, Hawaii, anything that you deem hurtful, Arizona. So it's like, and you don't see in those cases, parents like, running in and insisting that every little thing that they disagree with be swept out of the classroom. And so they're just part of the, you know, there's always going to be extreme circumstances. And part of the law is like learning how the courts can filter these out. It won't be as bad as either side wants to make you think. There's a way to kind of like set rules that allow 99% of Americans to live side by side without having to kind of compromise their core beliefs or their views of themselves.
And I think you did a good job of making that point. And I thought you used the example from the footnote of they have an opt-out for Muslim parents in particular for just the picture of Muhammad. So I thought that was really effective. I was amused when Justice Kavanaugh mentioned that he lives in Montgomery County and was basically, why are they doing this?
I couldn't resist saying, me too. You know, the sad thing is that there really is a wonderful tradition in Montgomery County of being very accommodating for all kinds of different diverse beliefs and people. I mean, we are one of the most diverse counties in the nation. It's been ranked the number one diverse religious county in the nation for like 3 years in a row. And so it was awesome that the board had a policy that said anything that violates your substantial, your interferes with your, actually their language was really right out of the textbooks. Anything that imposes a substantial burden on your religious beliefs, you can opt out. And that worked really well. That's been going on for decades. And so to say all of a sudden that we can't do it, just kind of really shows there was something happening at the board where they took an extreme ideological bent and said, nope, we're going to push this through to the end.
One of our viewers actually asked that question, given the outrageous comments made during the board meeting by members of the board. Obviously, they had not vetted their comments with their lawyer. Do you think some of those parents had a personal claim for the slander that was engaged in by the public officials?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, we didn't pursue that, but that certainly, it certainly seemed like, I mean, being told that you're a xenophobe or white supremacist, that's, you know, it's kind of, if I remember correctly, maybe per se libel. So there is, it's pretty serious. The funny thing is, you know, it wasn't just one board member. There was one primarily who made some of the statements. There's also a county board member who made it, made similar statements, and nobody disavowed these statements. Even after they were made meeting after meeting, no one stepped up and said, hey, you know, where was the lawyer saying, hey, you've got to watch this or don't do this. So yeah, they should, they have to own now, I think, the statement, because they could have disavowed it at any course in this litigation and said like, hey, that was, I mean, first time today was the time I heard him say anything about like, oh, that was intemperate. It's like, no, that was actually hateful and bigoted. And that board member should have had some kind of consequence. I mean, I know she actually did end up getting unelected, but unfortunately not for that reason.
So another viewer has expressed the concern. Some of our early conscience cases, of course, as you know, were grounded not in the First Amendment, but rather in the draft statute and allowed secular reasons for objections. And the viewer is asking, you know, if you win this case, what does that portend for parents who are either agnostic or atheist, the secularist who notwithstanding, it's not grounded in the belief that God created man and woman or something like that, but rather is grounded in the idea that there's
biology or
nature. Yes.
Yeah, it's a great question. And one we also, you know, we certainly, well, I would say two things. One, just getting the religious opt-outs, like most of these objections are religious, just as a matter of fact. And so once the board starts giving those, there's no incentive for it to draw the line at other parents who object. And so we think that this will be very helpful to everybody. But we also agree that, you know, there is a fundamental right here under, you know, whether it's under the substance of due process clause or privileges and immunities, you know, Professor Hamburger has proposed there's kind of a speech theory that when you compel education, you're compelling speech. You know, they're compelling students to listen to speech that they don't want to listen to. And I do think there's a credible claim there, and that someday the court should address that as well. But I think this is a great, you know, a win in this case would be a great opening for parents of all faith or no faith.
Well, and perhaps the other avenue, I remember in the Hot and Sexy case, that case was brought not only by parents, but by some of the students themselves who were deeply offended by the production that was put on in the guise of being a high school rally of some sort, assembly. You did not argue, and I think it's obvious why, but talk a little bit about students' rights in this context.
Yeah, we actually have two of the named plaintiffs have two of their daughters in the case. And then some of the families in Kids First also have their kids in. But, you know, for preliminary injunction, we were trying to go for the most straightforward path. And I think for reaching the most number of justices going through for the parents, in Yoder, the court left open, what if there's a conflict between parents, 17, 18? That question's left open. But yeah, I do think there's also a right for kids. Of course, when your kids are in elementary school, they don't really have the ability to kind of articulate this or have their own, you know, they're relying heavily on their parents' beliefs. And so that's really why we focused on the rights of the parents.
Well, it's surely not a Tinker case at pre-K. So with the armband.
Right.
Man, right. So... do you, given this, I'm still sort of dumbfounded that Montgomery County hasn't just said it's not worth the time and the money to do this. Do you have any insight into what's happening?
You know, I mean, the people that have done public records are hail for this. And it's like, you know, our parents are outraged. Like, how can we spend over, you know, it was definitely over $1 million. I can't remember how if it was getting close to two or not, but it's like, can we really afford to be doing this? And at the same time, Montgomery County scores, you know, math, reading, their basic education scores have been failing dramatically. And there's a sense that maybe is because administrators have lost the vision. They're not focused on the core educational, the things that unite us, we want all want our kids to have. And instead, they're kind of pushing these extreme agendas, trying to solve, excuse me, you know, the social problems that they see in the world, which I'm not trying to diminish those, but it's really not the role of the school is to be kind of social engineering how kids think about these kinds of issues. And the best way to promote kind of unity within a school district is exactly allowing opt-outs. It's like, we learn people are going to disagree with you in your life. That's okay. We can still be friends. They can go to the library when they don't want to do certain things. You can do the same thing when you don't want to do certain things. And we can then go back into the next class and we can still be friends. And that's really the message that I would like to see come from this case, is that disagreement is inevitable. It doesn't mean disrespect or dislike or anything else. It's just like recognizing that as human beings, we have values that can be very different from one another. And we can still be friends, neighbors, colleagues. We can all be children of the same God. You know, that's really my takeaway, is we're all children of the same God. We have to learn to get along in one way or another. And this is the way that the government can help do that. But instead of forcing people to believe, do things that they don't agree with, kind of helping us live in a pluralistic society side by side.
Well, but I would say that defense counsel argued vehemently that this was all about teaching kindness, teaching mutual respect, and that the objection in this case would essentially eradicate the school's ability to teach the, you know, sort of Mr. Rogers, who I happen to admire, but the my neighbor sort of philosophy. You seem to contest that as a matter of the record as well.
Well, I think, you know, Justice opposing counsel, like, thank you. This was a tough case to argue. It's like, yeah, like the rest say this is just about inclusivity. And look at the teacher's guidance. It's like, where is the reference to kindness and respect? No, it's always about like the ideology. That's the emphasis, the overwhelming evidence. I mean, the Montgomery County's own principals. You can imagine this is like their principals union. This is hardly a bastion of conservatism. They wrote a letter to the board saying, we don't think these books are appropriate for kids of these age. Teachers shouldn't, adult, you know, one of the books is about a fourth grader who falls in love with another fourth grade girl who falls in love with another fourth grade girl. And it's, you know, it's like, she blushes hot and she's like, oh, Myra's magnificent. And oh, my heart's going thumpity thump. And teachers are supposed to talk about like how it feels when you don't just love someone, but love someone. And the principal said, look, teachers should not be talking to kids about what it feels like to fall in love. That's just inappropriate, regardless of sexual orientation. That is not an appropriate elementary school topic. And I think that's right. And, you know, just, you know, they worried that the teacher's guidance was shaming towards students who disagreed, dismissive of religious beliefs, you know, age inappropriate. So, and you know, notably, they also said, look, if we have to do this instruction, it's going to breach the trust the teachers have with anyway. So I think that was the hard. I mean, you know, Alan is a great guy. He's a great lawyer. I thought he did a great job. I thought he had a very hard record to argue with.
So Beckett has been remarkably successful, not only you, although in large part because of you and because of Mark and because of the great lawyers you have there. One of the viewers just asked, he said, can I just ask the fun question of what are the traditions that you follow in preparing for a Supreme Court case like this?
Oh, that's fun. Well, this is my first Supreme Court argument. So I don't know that I have traditions yet, but I will say that we have a great camaraderie within Beckett, and everyone feels very open to like to help out, to pitch in. Nobody feels like constrained to their own cases. So a ton of, you know, we did a lot of internal moots, just kind of people sitting down with me and kind of throwing questions at me. I will just share another tradition. We have a bell, a Liberty bell in the office that we ring for all of our wins. So that's kind of a tradition that's built up over time that I, you know, I'm hoping we'll get to ring the bell here in and while for my personal preparation, it was more just like, I'm just kind of a buckle down and sweat through stuff and try to get it done. Eat a fair bit of ice cream when I can.
So you don't have any special socks or tie that you wear?
No.
I heard one appellate advocate argue for his special socks.
I mean, now this tie is definitely being like, okay, maybe I'll wear it again next time if it comes.
So another viewer, and I had the same thoughts as I was listening to the argument. You didn't argue this, and I'm not sure it's a satisfactory resolution, but I will say toward the first half of the argument, I thought, oh dear, we're going to get another masterpiece cake opinion because of the bad behavior of the board.
Yeah.
And is that as disastrous as I think it is?
I really don't want that to happen, right? That's another example. It's like the worst case scenario of like, okay, so you lose on this board, loses on this one case. We go back and just be nice about the way we cancel your opt-outs. I think the court's probably aware of that. I think both the Solicitor General and I, we tried to avoid seeing too much on that because it's really not a great place for the court to rule. It's really a waste of the court's resources, in my opinion. Like they take this case, they have argument, and then they just say like, "Oh, you were too mean." Like, no, like let's deal with the substantive issues and move forward.
One of the viewers asks about the question, did any of the justices bring up evolution? And as a matter of fact, a couple of them did, although just fleetingly. How did you prepare for that question?
Yeah, again, that fell into the category of like, initially I was like, okay, maybe the government has a more compelling interest there. And there certainly is a point where the state has a compelling interest in making sure the students receive a basic education that allows them to become self-sufficient, productive students. But if you think about, you know, in Yoder, the court kind of said the three R's, you have to be able to read, write, and reason or do arithmetic. And I think that's actually a pretty good thing. You think about what we do today, like we don't make everyone take calculus. We don't make everyone in high school understand quantum physics. You know, we try to introduce, I think it makes a lot of sense that to introduce the evolution's a theory that's out there. It shouldn't be a problem. And most people, again, don't object to that. But there's nothing special about evolution that you would say like, oh, we have to have this in there. And it's kind of like, it's everyone's favorite bogeyman, but it's like, does it really matter? Like a lot of us really don't understand the theory of evolution that well. I mean, every time I go to I was just there again, the Smithsonian, where they have a whole section. It's like, oh, wow. Like, I don't really, this is so complicated. And, you know, I don't know a lot about this. And we survive as adults, you know, we're productive. We're happy. So this idea that there are certain things that people have to know, it's really just like, again, like, no, you know, we don't make homeschoolers study evolution. We don't make private schools introduce evolution. Most high schoolers, you know, besides some kind of like a general biology class where you get like passing, you know, a brief kind of reference to it, we don't make high schoolers. It's elective if you want to go kind of deep on evolution. So again, I think it's like, if someone really, really objects, which again, doesn't happen that much, what's the problem of letting them opt out?
Well, and in fact, it's my understanding that for a short period of time, Washington State actually taught intelligent design as an alternative theory. Just here is another theory, which in some ways was a more sophisticated, although... Yeah. The authors
and if someone wanted
to get me, but
yeah, well, if someone wanted to opt out of that, good for them. You right. know, it's just like I think we kind of sometimes have this idea that the public schools are like the end all be all. And if we don't have everything, this, you know, every student being indoctrinated, that was actually kind of like what led to the Blaine era conflicts. Like, oh, we have all these, you know, and which oddly, the other side cited some of these cases saying like, oh, we have these masses of Catholics coming in and they won't integrate if we don't force them through our Protestant, you know, tinged schools. And, you know, interestingly, they also cited another case that internally cited a case that was about upholding segregation to make sure that, you know, we could let boards on it and respect the mission of school boards and things like that. So that's kind of the tradition they were drawing on. And I thought Justice Alito was like, why did you cite those cases? And, you know, that's not the tradition that we adopted in Meyer, Pierce, Barnett, Yoder. The tradition there we adopted into the First Amendment or recognized in the First Amendment was this tradition of parents really have the most vested interest in their kids. They're the people who are most likely to love their kids the best. And the First Amendment is going to protect the right of those parents to direct their children's upbringing.
I was also surprised that PICO didn't come up, the case about school libraries and removal of books, especially when they start out so quickly about, you know, well, what's the difference between indoctrination and simply exposure and that sort of thing. Were you surprised by that? Were you prepared for PICO?
I was prepared for it, but it's funny. It never came up in any of the moots. So it was, you know, I thought it would, and nobody really ever kind of made the connection, I guess. So at least not that I recall. Of the formal and informal moots, nobody brought it up. So, you know.
Small blessings.
There will probably be another Pico case sometime soon. Yes.
So what would be, given that neither of us believe you're looking at a unanimous opinion of the court.
Right.
I don't know. It would have to be so narrow that it would do no good. What's your fondest hope for, based on today's
argument? Yeah, assuming that I know it's not possible, I would love to get a 7-0 decision. I feel like Kagan understood the problem. I mean, I actually loved interacting with Justice Kagan. She's very smart. You know, I was actually the most like, Justice Kagan is going to throw a bunch of crazy hypotheticals at me. But I actually really loved the interaction with her. Very respectful. She kind of acknowledged that I was trying to be open, you know, which I thought was nice. And I think she sees the problem. She is a little concerned about kind of what are the limits, and I respect that. But I would love to see her get on. I think the other option is, you know, this didn't come up as much. It did come up, but not as much as I thought it might. The board is pressing for the court just to decide the burden question and to remand for strict scrutiny. I think that would be a huge mistake. The parents have already waited 2 years for relief. In this case, the strict scrutiny question is so straightforward. There are so many opt-outs. You really can't justify denying them here. And if we go back down, it's like, how much is that another year waiting for relief? Do we have to go all the way back into the Supreme Court? And the court has almost always, we couldn't find any instance where the court didn't address, even where the lower courts never got to strict scrutiny, which happened in Fulton, Carson versus Macon, Reed versus City of Arizona. The Ramirez case was a little bit different, but a kind of some similar context where the court went ahead and did strict scrutiny anyway, even though the lower courts hadn't addressed it. So my hope is that they'll do that, but it's possible that that the court could just remand. Again, we think that would be a mistake, and the court might as well give guidance now. This was a preliminary injunction. The board had a chance to make a record. It didn't make the record. It's really not that big of a deal to say, yeah, for now, you haven't met strict scrutiny. Maybe they can do more on the merits when we go back down. But for a preliminary injunction, it seems important to hold the board to its standard. And, having failed to show strict scrutiny or satisfy strict scrutiny, then we should have that protection in place.
Do you have any hope that there would be a change in the board and the leadership of the board so that this case could be resolved amicably?
Certainly. I mean, I think at this point it would be a waste of, again, the court's resources of taking the case and not rule. So I think I don't see that likely. The parents, a lot of parents, a lot of community organizations have been working hard on the last election in particular to try to get people in who would support the parents. They made a little bit of progress, but in Montgomery County, it's really hard to kind of, you know, there's what they call the Apple ballot. I one time supported someone who was not on the Apple ballot. The Apple ballot is basically the list of here's the teachers the union endorses. And like, it felt like 80% of the voters came in and just said, where's the Apple ballot? They would take the Apple ballot, take it in and check the boxes. So it's really hard to break into the school board if you don't have the union's endorsement. And the union was endorsing, you know, all people who kind of supported the board's position on this. So I think that that would be great in the long term to have that remedy. But the Bill of Rights is to protect parents who fall on the wrong side of the majority, you know, whether for whatever reason, the Bill of Rights is there to protect people who have a minority viewpoint on issues of great importance, religion, speech, things like that. And we just think the court, you know, we're hopeful that the court will, you know, apply the Bill of Rights and protect our clients.
So we're getting close to the end of our time. I'm sure Marco will keep us on time, but something that troubles me and that came up a couple of times was the glib answer that, well, you don't have to put your children in public schools. And if this is really objectionable to you, go put your child in a private school or homeschool. And I thought you were really effective in making the point that even homeschooling in the two career tango, that means somebody's given up their gainful employment. And Do you foresee any time in the future where that won't be sort of the justification that public schools can pretty much do what they want as long as they get the board vote?
Yeah, I was kind of surprised by that line of questioning, honestly, just because, you know, it's so obvious. There are so many, you know, Montgomery County is a very welcoming community for immigrants. We have lots of parents who are first or second generation members here, often still trying to kind of get their feet under their economically, often working a lot of, you know, two jobs. There are a lot of single parents. There's so many hard situations. And it was hard to hear kind of this argument of like, oh, you know, the single mom with two jobs, she's got other options. It's like, really? Yeah. No options for that individual to like homeschool or to send her kids to private school. And so I know that there's always kind of this element of exploring options. And I hope that that one kind of goes down as like, okay, that one didn't work out so well.
I see. Oh, wait a minute. We may have had a final question come in. The classic solution for these sorts of problems is, in fact, vouchers. Did that come up at all in the conversation? I don't remember it coming up.
Yeah, it didn't come up. You know, and Rebecca, we don't really take a position on vouchers, but, you know, there is this sense of like, I'm paying for my kid to go to school and now you're going to... I don't know. One line I didn't get out, you know, I got cut off a little bit at the end because I didn't notice the light go off. But, you know, one of the things I want to say is like, when it comes to parental rights in education, the First Amendment would be meaningless if you can force parents to pay taxes to fund the school, force them to send their kids there because there's no other alternatives, and you find them if they don't go to school, indoctrinate them however you want, and then you just tell people like, oh, you have options. I mean, yeah, so... vouchers obviously would solve a lot of those problems, but you know, Rebecca, we don't take a position on that, and it didn't come up in this case. But it's certainly there were a lot of things that gave cause for ongoing conversation on how we better fund education and meet the needs of a very diverse society.
And then I guess the final question we had are, what are the odds that the court will address the in loco parentis doctrine in general? And are you familiar with Justice Thomas's thoughts on that subject?
Yeah, great question, and that was. You know, Thomas and Alito have both spoken on it, and they differ a little bit on like, you know, Thomas takes a kind of a stricter view that like parents have the rights, not the kids. As I understand it, I think, you know, if it had come up, I was going to say like, look, I think most of the court agrees that in loco parentis is understood as a doctrine where parents have delegated rights to the, you know, school. It can be a doctrine where then the school can then exclude the parents because it's based on delegation. So I think if it does come up, it could come up. It didn't come up today.
Well, this has been a very fun conversation, and I'm very, very much excited to wait for the judgment. I think you're going to win it, but people who make those sorts of prophecies often, I don't make my living.
Never know. You never know what will happen, but I thought we did. I thought we put our best case forward.
I thought you did a really wonderful job representing the interests of your clients. And I think the justices were largely very thoughtful about
very much so
the importance of parents in children's lives and their ability to shape their children's morals. And so I'll be anxiously awaiting it. So
wonderful. I will say what a wonderful experience. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you everybody for viewing us in this podcast, and what a wonderful maiden voyage for your first Supreme Court argument.
Thank you so much. It was a great, it was a lot of fun.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.